Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, host David Bell brings in a panel of guests that include local Bishop Eric D. Morrison of the New Vision Worldwide Fellowship of Churches, Dion Sankar, Assistant Jackson County Prosecutor and Supervisor of Diversionary Programs, and Ellen Suni, the Dean Emeritus of UMKC Law School. They will talk about the collateral effects to families when a loved one is convicted of a crime and expungement under Missouri law, as well as an expungement clinic to be held by the students of the UMKC School of Law. Our calendar of events will be at the end of the broadcast, right before the 420 drug war news. Now, here is David and his guest.
Good morning, this is David Bell, and you're listening to 90.1 KKFI, Jaws of Justice. Today, we're going to talk about punishment, but in a different manner than we've spoken about before. In particular, we're going to talk about the punishment that continues on after the formal judiciary punishment has been handed out in cases. And that is a criminal record, and in particular, what are the collateral consequences of having one? I'm joined today by three very knowledgeable and wonderful people. I've got Dean Suni from the UMKC Law School. Good morning, Dean.
Good morning.
Thank you. I've got Bishop Morrison of Kingdom Word Ministries. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I've got Dion Sankar, Assistant Prosecuting Attorney and Head of the Diversion and Drug Court Programs with the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. Good morning, Dion.
Good morning.
What we're going to talk about a little bit is, first of all, what is a record? And then we're going to go into what are some of the collateral consequences. We're going to talk about how do we avoid those collateral consequences. And then we're going to talk about a new and exciting part of Missouri law and something that Dean Suni is putting together at UMKC Law School. The first thing I want to talk about briefly is what is a record. People come to me and say, is this going to be on my record, whether it's a criminal conviction or whatever. And I think we first need to explore what is a record. First of all, in almost every interaction with law enforcement, there is a record created. Whether you're just being stopped to be spoken with, whether you're arrested, you're charged, indictment, or guilty plea, then there's records of probation and things like that. As to who's keeping those records, we've got the government that keeps them. We've got private companies that keep them. And then we've got the internet, which is this kind of amorphous thing that never goes away. And so I guess first I want to open it up to the panel here. With regard to records, what do you believe the records that we're talking about? Because ultimately what we're wanting to focus on are those things that occur or stay around after formal punishment that impact someone's ability to do something they want to do, whether it be job, housing, benefits, whatever. So let's start. Dion, what would you consider a record that we're dealing with here?
Well, I think traditionally the criminal justice system has always kind of housed a historical database for individuals that have been convicted. So we at the prosecutor's office would see those records in the sense of if someone has been convicted of a crime, they could be on probation with the conviction, or they could be convicted after a trial, or they could have pled guilty. And from our perspective, we look at those records as a potential, really as a database to figure out who the individual is that's coming back before us to determine what type of options are there to resolve their current or pending case that they have. So from our perspective, that's the way that we view the past conduct. Now, we have in most recent years, due to our elected's efforts on this point, really taken a deeper look at those convictions. We recognize, obviously, that folks plead guilty for plenty of reasons. Trials end up in guilty verdicts for plenty of reasons. So the fact that someone has pled guilty is not a dispositive, or it doesn't end the analysis for us to determine whether or not some leniency should be granted to an individual. Rather, we look at the circumstances, the facts of the case that they pled guilty to determine what's right for this individual. It's really about figuring out what is the right thing for this individual in this case at this time.
Great. And so with regard to the records you're talking about records kept by the government. I will tell you, when people come to me and ask me, they say, David, you know, again, is it going to be on my record? When we talk about records, again, that's any information regarding arrest, charge, whatever. What I generally see, however, from employers and other individuals or entities interested is the record with regard to the conclusion of the case when it ends in a guilty plea or a guilty verdict and then a conviction. Generally speaking, in my experience at least, the arrest and charge by itself is not enough because at that point there's not been a determination by a neutral body, being the judge, that something in fact happened or that the allegation is true. Do you find that to be accurate, Dion?
I find that to be kind of the complexity of this issue.
Right.
You have a in the criminal justice system, there is a way to track contacts, what we call contacts with law enforcement. That can also be impactful on an individual because the number of contacts they have, their arrest records, depending on who's searching and the resources of the searching person, that can also be impactful. The fact that no charge would come after an arrest or an initial amount of police contact may be helpful from the criminal justice perspective. That'd be difficult for me to speak to from an employment perspective.
Sure.
But I think that that would be up to an individual employer and the circumstances. But I think that it's because of that that I think that the initial contacts are somewhat important and can also have a lasting impact in addition to the convictions and things like that.
And so let me speak briefly to an example I had. I had a professional come to me. He was arrested, and I'm going to change the facts slightly just because of the anonymity that I want to keep. But he was arrested for a robbery in a popular area in town. We'll call it Waldo. And the reason he was arrested is because he was nearby where the incident is alleged to have occurred, and the police scooped up him and two or three other people. He was booked on a 24-hour hold, and when they book him on a 24-hour hold, they actually wrote in robbery on there. They have to have some reason that they list on the sheet to hold him. He's released. No charges are ever filed against him. Fast forward, let's say, 5 years. He has become a professional that requires some licensing with the state. He then fills out an application, and his license is denied because it shows that he has been convicted or arrested for this robbery. And so we had to go in and actually prove a negative that he had not been. And so that was just an example from an employment standpoint that I've seen, or from a licensing standpoint, where we have that. I think I want to then move, though, briefly. So, well, hold on. Before we do that, we have government, and then we've got the internet. I don't know, Dean Suni, have you seen that with regard to the internet, this idea of a record, whatever it's a record of, that just stays around forever? It's not maintained by the government. It's maintained by something other than the government.
That is a concern. And as I understand the expungement statute, it's a really open question whether we're going to be able to do anything about that kind of record. The expungement will allow any state or municipal or police agency that has records to be forced to seal those records and not release them to anyone. And that really is what expungement is. Now, there's a place on the existing form that allows you to list other possible defendants, because anybody who is going to be impacted by an expungement order has a right to oppose it and be heard about it. Whether these private entities that collect and distribute this kind of data can be affected by these expungement orders is really an open question.
Right. And so I think one point that I've seen in my own practice is an individual arrested, they're booked into a jail. It doesn't have to necessarily be Jackson County Jail. It could be any local jail. And the charge is listed there. The charge which that they're booked under is listed there. And let's say that there is a private entity, the internet, whatever it may be, that takes an image of that at that moment. Well, if that case is later dismissed, there's no image necessarily to be taken of. And so all that then exists in this whatever it is this image of this individual with this charge on it, and that sticks. And to the extent that that gets sucked up into some private database that is then sold to employers and things like that, then that's where sometimes we have the issue. And there's no way of getting rid of it other than paying some reputation expert or whatever to push your search past page one of Google, because no one ever looks at page two. But I briefly now want to go into, if I can, the collateral consequences that we're talking about. And I have Bishop Morrison here. And I know, Bishop Morrison, you've worked with a lot of individuals, as we all have, but you've worked with a lot of individuals who either have come out of the criminal justice system or are trying to get out. And I'm curious, from your perspective, what type of roadblocks you see for those individuals that are labeled felon.
Thank you, David. There is a plethora of reasons behind and what they have shared with me coming out of the criminal justice system in respect to the lack of job opportunities. And it's intriguing that you would, you know, share with us the them asking, you know, is this going to be on my record? Because that is the primary line of interest. They come, Bishop, I have this on my record, and I don't, and I can't get this off my record. And that has been one of the things, because it helped, it hurts them in, you know, with their families. It hurts them with, you know, looking for housing, jobs, et cetera. And so one of the hurtful places that, you know, we as pastors have to contend with is the inability to go in and go behind closed doors with a judge and say, can you help this young man, because some of it was wrong. He was wrongfully accused, as you brought up the robbery. I was there. I got arrested, but they never convicted me, and I never was indicted or anything of that nature, but I'm plagued with this, you know.
So, and what do you, I'm just curious about from a theological standpoint, we can bring it in just for a second. We've got a situation where, let's say someone is good for it. Let's say they do 2 or 3 years in prison, whatever it may be, and they get out. I know there's this idea in religion, particularly Christianity, I think, of a forgiveness or whatever, and we move on. But the criminal justice system, it doesn't seem to have that.
And that's because most of the gentlemen that are incarcerated and women incarcerated, most of them find a place in religion, you know, whether it's Islam, Christianity. And when they come out, they're looking for that to be the bedrock to move them to, you know, the next level of life, get back into the mainstream of a citizenship. But you're on this side, you know, telling them the Lord has forgiven you. And you need to, you know, just endure and know that God is going to open the door over here. Somebody is going to pardon you. Somebody's going to forgive you. But that system, because of the way it has been established, you know, it isn't. It's just, you know, it's like a beast that is going to consistently be right there to keep you mindful of the mistake that you made, even though you've been forgiven.
And what do you think about the, in your experience you've seen, from like the psychological impact, or however you want to describe it, of someone who's labeled a felon? There seems to be in our society this desire to label people, to somehow divide and conquer. I don't know what other reason it would be, but have you personally seen that in terms of the impact of someone who walks around and has to say, I am a felon?
Yes, just recently, a young man, he's working a few jobs now just so that he can provide for his family. But he has had a felon. And man, I introduced him to you, and we're not saying any names, but that's all he could say to the other entrepreneurs, the people that had positions on their jobs, that had the ability to hire. You know, he would go to them and say, you know, is your place of employment, do they hire felons? You know, because I'm a felon. And that psychologically, you know, is incriminating not only to them, but to the family, because now the family addresses them in that same mannerism. You know, you're a felon. And so those type of things that, you know, it takes a while to work it out of them. You know, you have to change the paradigm of way of thinking.
Well, thank you. So now I want to briefly talk, before I get to Dion, I want to provide a website to people. And this is a website where you can go in, choose your jurisdiction, choose the type of crime or the category of crime, and determine from that the benefits that you will be deprived of. And when I say benefits, I mean not only financial benefits in terms of housing potentially, but also voting rights, unable to be on a jury, unable to serve in certain jobs that require licensing. And then we have this general label that Bishop Morrison has talked about. The website is niccc.csjjusticecenter.org. And maybe the better way is just look up Justice Center, the Council of State Governments. the website unfortunately doesn't just roll off my tongue, but mm-hmm. you can get there. You choose a jurisdiction, and it's really incredible. When I was going through it last night, just in Missouri, what I was seeing was just an unbelievable amount of things that are denied to felons. I almost got to the point where it might have been easier for this website just to list what you could still do rather than what you can't do anymore. But that being said, because of that, I guess the impact of a felony and the impact of the criminal justice system on individuals, there have been some programs that have been developed to literally divert them from that criminal justice system to avoid these negative collateral consequences. And that's why we've asked Dion from the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office to be here. Dion, what do you have in place at your office to help avoid these consequences that we're talking about?
Sure, thank you. And again, thanks for this opportunity. This is a conversation that our office is very passionate about. We have long held in Jackson County that we want to treat the folks that we are mad at, so the folks that have property crimes, drug crimes, things like that, differently than the folks that we're afraid of, the folks that have violent crimes, sex crimes, and things like that. So we have kind of a tiered system, the first of which is this. We are now in a situation with our jail that requires us to look at who's incarcerated or who's detained pre-trial. So we are looking at different ways in which we should be reviewing bonds to determine that if someone is there, that they are there because we are appropriately concerned about them, we're afraid of them, as opposed to we're mad at them and we need to do something differently. In addition to that, we currently have a structure in place in which we review the charges that are initially filed to determine independently from the person who's filing them. We do a grand jury review of it to make sure that what we've got in place is actually the correct charge, actually the correct person, so that we just don't push someone along kind of an assembly line structure of criminal justice and put them in jeopardy of going before a judge or a jury for a potential criminal conviction. Now, in that review, we also do some things that we hope can help out. And it's really geared towards a lot of different parts of the criminal justice system that I think we who are in the system are troubled with. And that is obviously we've got the folks that need treatment. And drug court has been a prominent and a very successful program in Jackson County since the early 90s. To date, we have over 2,500 folks that have graduated from drug court, which means that's 2,500 folks that would have been otherwise brandished with the scarlet letter of a felony, and they have now received treatment, and they have moved on the line and hopefully are leading productive lives. Our drug court system is a diversion-based system. It is one of, I think, the only one in this state that is a pre-conviction, meaning that you don't have to plead guilty to receive the treatment. It treats the folks who are the users. It treats the folks that commit crimes to use. It treats the folks that are just the fringe users as well, because I think all those folks need an individualized mechanism to deal with the addiction issues that they have or the connection to drugs that they have. Within that, I'm sorry.
Dion, just real quick, mm-hmm. you mentioned it was a pre-conviction. Could you explain to the listeners why this program avoids the collateral consequences that we're talking about? How do you physically do it? What happens after you complete the program, and why we avoid the stigma of felon?
Sure.
Or how, I guess, we avoid it.
Yeah, so our drug court program will initially be that the person, let's just say a person is charged with the possession of a drug. Their case will be initially screened by the office, and then they'll be diverted right into the drug court program, which means that they'll get a risk assessment. They'll be put within an individualized quadrant, which means that there'll be a treatment plan specifically catered to that person. They'll appear before the judge, and if they are clean for 180 days, then they will graduate from drug court. What that means is that at that point, the case is dismissed with prejudice, which means that it can never be filed again. The case is effectively over and sealed and done. That will allow this person who otherwise has probably had minimal, if no contact with the criminal justice system, to go on with their life free from the stigma of a felony conviction, because we're talking about a felony level drug charge. And we hope that will, again, from our perspective, do two things. One, offer that individual a measure of justice. You earned your right away from the conviction by going through the program, showing the court prosecutor's office and defense counsel that you have done the work to beat the issue that you have. And simultaneously, it also allows this for us. We have seen a steady rate of folks that repeat conduct. And when you have a felony conviction that creates a barrier for you in terms of employment, as Bishop indicated, and as David indicated, and Dean Suni as well, that opens up some doors that we don't want. So we want to offer you an opportunity to basically take the other path. And you have to earn it. But when you earn it, you've earned it from us. And now we hope you go on and you don't have that conviction so that there aren't those barriers for you that are in place. If I may go on, David.
Yeah, sure.
The other parts of that program that I think are so interesting and I think hit on some of the other issues that we've seen in the criminal justice system is mental health. That is a common denominator that we struggle with in the criminal justice system, what to do with folks that have mental health. Division 50, which is our treatment court division, does attach itself to folks mental that treat their mental health, attach them to community resources. Now, in some instances, we can do those in a pre-filing way. Our office is partnered with the Department of Mental Health to strip out some beds for treatment out in the community, which means folks do not have to go down to a Department of Mental Health facility for treatment. They can be restored out of custody, and then we will divert their charge, which means they will not have a conviction if they are able to be restored and we are able to proceed forward with a diversion agreement. We've also had a very successful Veterans Court program here, which is again geared towards folks that have served in our military. That's a unique subset of our community that trouble with some post-traumatic stress disorders and things like that. And we can still deal with those folks in a pre-plea, pre-conviction way to allow them to continue on given the sacrifices they've made for our country. And we think that that's also an important subset. And when you even take out the treatment element of it, since Jean Peters-Baker has been in office, she's been readily concerned with the idea that we've got folks that have property crimes that commit those crimes because of poverty. And we've created a New Start diversion program which addresses the issue of the property offender. So the individual who steals a car, even at a felony level, the idea of restorative justice in that program is that that person is going to pay back the restitution, make it right with the victim, communicate directly with the victim in terms of an apology, and after a diversion period, no conviction, no plea, and we hope that we can move them out of the criminal justice system. We've even created a program out in East Zone that is a community-based program. Someone would go before the community board that they're in, and if they've committed a property crime, they will speak directly to the community that's been harmed to try to figure out whether or not there is a restorative path to justice that is outside of the bounds of a courtroom where a conviction can provide a stigma or roadblock to them for the duration of their life. And finally, because obviously we recognize that there's going to be circumstances where the case is just a little bit in what we call a little bit too hot for us to put into a diversion program. But if there is a conviction that needs to be reviewed, our office has taken on the task of actually setting up a conviction review unit that will allow for us to determine if we've got something, a new piece of evidence that the community wants us to look at, a lawyer wants us to look at from an old conviction. They can go through the process on our website of filling out a worksheet, submitting the case to us, and we can take a look at it. Now, in those situations, we're looking for essentially a case of actual innocence where someone's giving us information that says this person is actually innocent. There's an appellate process that covers some of the other ways in which there's different types of relief, like a new trial. But if there's something that comes up, the mechanism we have in place is just based on the simple fact that we want to get it right. We are obviously concerned with the fact that we see folks again and again. From the resource perspective, we don't want another file on our desk. We want the community to have faith in the system and create a system that is fair in this county because we think that that's what this county deserves.
Another diversion program, but not directly through the prosecutor's office, is youth court. And UMKC School of Law actually houses the Kansas City Youth Court. And I was involved back years and years ago with Commissioner Watson and the police and the courts and the prosecutors in the juvenile court creating that program. There's one in Independence, there's one in Eastern Jackson County, And those are diversion programs as well that have been certified by the family court, and they do the same thing for young people. The crime can't be too serious, but the police and the family court send those cases to the Kansas City Youth Court, and they have hearings every other week, and it's young people who are the lawyers and the judges for these juveniles. And so you have a lot of peer involvement in those cases. And that has been very successful in avoiding recidivism or otherwise repeat offenses. So,
I guess, Deanna, you mentioned one thing I'm really intrigued by. Mm-hmm. You mentioned one of these programs involves the meeting or potential, not necessarily meeting, but apology of the offender with the victim, and I guess, is that accurate? Which program is that sometimes provides for that?
Sure, that's the New Start Diversion Program, and that's the program in which we carve off, if you've got a substance abuse issue, it's drug court, it could potentially be mental health court, it could potentially be vet court. But if it's a property crime or a crime in between substance abuse and a violent crime, then in that situation where it's a potential, let's take a car theft, for instance, tampering, as we call it in Missouri. If you've stolen a car and you've been charged with a felony, look, this is a situation in which we can find a measure of justice in between a conviction and prison time or even probation, where the whatever damage has been caused by the act, that damage can be replaced, it can be paid for, and we can have you write an apology letter. Sometimes folks can even speak directly to the victim. And we've seen very positive strands from the victims involved in those cases who, I've had one situation in which a victim actually said, look, I can find this person a mentorship. I can find them a job. It was someone who caused some property damage. And they said, look, this person spray painted my business, but they seem very talented. And I want to find them a job. So you have those situations, and there are, you know, more so than what you think, people understand that there's a lot of different reasons why bad conduct happens. And not all bad conduct should get that scarlet letter. So the victim part of it is a huge piece for us. It's huge because it allows the person who caused the act to actually meet eye to eye with someone else or write a letter that sets them in the right path thereafter and know my conduct caused this harm and I want to apologize for it. And we hope that resets them because we think that that's a critical part of where the restorative justice piece should go in those types of programs.
And Bishop, let me ask you a question I hear the term restorative justice. If a wrong is committed, and I'm not talking about just a legal wrong, but a wrong is committed, one person steals another person's car, how do you get that person that's committed the wrong to the best place possible so that they don't recommit it? And the reason I say that, and the reason I'm asking you, Bishop, is in my experience, deterrence by threat of punishment is not effective for a large number of individuals. I mean, if specific deterrence worked or general deterrence worked, then I would be out of a job and so would Dion. I mean, we wouldn't have one because no one would commit a crime to be fearful. What is it about the idea of meeting with the victim, do you think, apologizing and having some type of meeting of the minds that might help somebody not reoffend when the opportunity presents itself again?
I think David, that you have in that eye to eye contact after there has been this crime, and we use the car theft as an example, and this person now has to apologize to who they didn't even care about, whose car it belonged to. You know, their mind now is in a place of saying, I didn't know it was you, I'm sorry. And it's gonna add some character value to them that once wasn't there. You know, they now have to apologize to somebody that they didn't even know who it was. It's gonna add some character to them. You see people a little bit more humble, bring, you know, some humility in respect to, okay, and to have the victim inadvertently say it's okay, you know, this is what you did, and I hope that you don't do this again, adds again some validity to that person's character, like, okay, maybe this is something I need to stop doing. I didn't know I was causing this kind of an affliction.
is for, I'm just curious, in your religion, or at least how you practice it, forgiveness, obviously you need to ask forgiveness from God generally, but is part of the forgiveness that you preach to go out and seek that from the victim? I mean, is that from a spiritual standpoint? I'm just curious if now we're aligning these things, the spiritual and the legal system together.
Well, we have, from my platform and the parishioners, I tell you that is one of the key components of Christianity, is being able to forgive because the Lord has forgiven you. So practice that principle, you know, even when you are the victim. Mm-hmm. So that unforgiveness is not developed within your own heart and your own mind. And so, yes, to push the envelope on forgiveness, we address it, and that's my place, David, is don't look for a response, because you should be doing it from your heart. Whether the person did it to you or you did it to them, you need to ask for forgiveness to free you up, first of all, from the crime that was committed. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't ask no one to forgive you in hope that they say, I forgive you. You should do it because it is a principle of Christianity.
And David, these programs, victim offender reconciliation programs, within the criminal justice area, are fairly popular because they are pretty effective. And I'm glad to hear that that Jackson County has a program like that. And in fact, in the youth court program, which also allows for expungement of any record, the judge often orders an apology.
And I think with that, we're going to take our break just a sec. When we come back, what we're going to talk about is what happens if someone doesn't go through the diversion program. What happens if, because of the nature of the crime, they wind up going to trial, they're convicted, and now they have this label on them. What do they do? Dean Suny is here to talk about a new and, I think, exciting statute that's just become effective and the programs that she is working on at UMKC. And we'll be back after the break. This is Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. I'm here today with a wonderful group of people. We have Dean Suny from UMKC Law School. We have Bishop Morrison, and we have Dion Sankar from the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. What we were talking about before the break was this idea of diverting from the criminal justice system, although it's somewhat still involved, in order to avoid a criminal conviction because of the stigma that's attached and the kind of the lifelong punishment that results from it long after the judicially imposed punishment has ended. And I will tell you, in other states, for example, Kansas, there is this idea of an expungement process that if you wind up going through the criminal justice system, you wind up being convicted, there's a method for you to have your criminal record expunged so that the punishment has effectively ended for you, or at least the collateral consequences of those. We didn't have that in Missouri for a long time. We had it for arrest records. I remember doing it, but it was a major pain in the rear, frankly, I'll tell you. And it was very, very limited. I remember there couldn't be probable cause for the crime to have been committed as one of the factors that you had to plead in order to get an expungement, and that's extremely difficult when probable cause is a relatively light standard, as it, maybe it needs to be for purposes of arrest. So with that, Missouri passed a law, and I think is going to allow what we're calling expungement. And again, expungement, just so we understand, is the ability to wipe the record clean. I will say Missouri had something that attempted to get there, and it was called suspended imposition of sentence. When you pled guilty or were found guilty, the court could suspend the imposition of sentence. And that says, the judge says, listen, I'm not going to give you a sentence right now. I'm going to suspend imposition of sentence, an SIS. And if you walk it down, your probation or whatever, there won't be anything on your record at the end. The reality is that there is always something on your record. What happens is that was not considered a conviction, nor is it to this day. However, the record still exists, and the way that employers get to it, as I've seen it, or the way the bar gets to it when I tried to become, unfortunately did become a lawyer, is they ask, have you ever been convicted? So the answer to that is no, if I would have ever pled guilty to a felony and received an SIS. But then they ask the question, have you ever pled guilty to a felony? And with that question, even though I'd never been convicted, I still have to report the SIS, and we're back to the same problem that we had before. So with that, I want to turn it over to Dean Suni, who I think is taking this idea of a post-guilty plea, post-conviction case and doing something with us to take us back to, hopefully, potentially the same place that Dion is taking us after we successfully complete a diversion.
Well, yes and no. I wish it was that extensive at this point. So Missouri did have an expungement statute before, but it was very, very restrictive. And so for a misdemeanor, it took 10 years after the last consequences of your conviction. For a felony, it was 20 years. And there were very, very few crimes that could be expunged. So the legislature in Missouri passed a law that expanded in some respects, but actually contracted or made smaller the statute in other respects. So it dramatically expanded the number of crimes, particularly minor crimes, that could be expunged. So it opens it up to many, many more people. In addition, it shortened the length of time that you have to wait. So now you only have to wait 3 years from, and this is important, from what we would call the final consequences of the conviction. So if you were on probation, it's from the time you're released from probation. If you were imprisoned and had probation, it's that longer period till after your probation finishes. In addition, you have to have paid any restitution, any fines. You cannot have reoffended or committed an additional crime in that whole period. And you have to meet some other standards. But there are certain, and there's a limit on the number. So you can only expunge one felony and two misdemeanors. Hmm. Now, that sounds like few, and it is. However, if a person is convicted of multiple felonies or misdemeanors or a combination of misdemeanors and felonies or pleads guilty to a combination, all arising out of one thing that happened, those count as one. And it's if the highest one was a felony, it counts as your felony. If all of them were misdemeanors, it counts as one of your two misdemeanors. So that, in a way, is good news. The bad news is that although the crimes have expanded a lot, many, many crimes still cannot be subject to expungement. And so that's something that we're still in the process of fully understanding which crimes can be, which crimes can't be, because it's very, very complicated. And that's part of the problem that the average person has, is trying to figure this out, because the statute gives you the numbers of these Missouri statutes and doesn't tell you about which ones they really are. So we're so when I say we, let me back up for a minute and explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. We have, first of all, we're doing it because our law school for quite some time has had, as part of our mission, access to justice for people who currently don't have the ability to get the services that people with money can get in the legal system as a whole, and the criminal part is one part of that. In advancing that interest and also in realizing how important technology is in the law today, we created back in 2014 a course called Law Technology and Public Policy. And in that class, we have law students, business students, engineering and computer science students. It's an interdisciplinary course, and we have faculty from those areas. And we've now, because of this project, expanded it to criminal justice students. And we work with the Kansas City Brigade of Code for America, which is a group of people who work in tech who can code, which is important in creating technology, and they do this on a volunteer basis. So we have lots of people in the community, and we work with the City of Kansas City, the City of Kansas City, Kansas, other municipalities, and some agencies that we can help with the fairly limited resources we have. So we decided, and that was me and someone from Code for America who's interested in this, I co-teach the class, we decided to do this Clear My Record Expungement Project as one of our three projects in the class this semester. And the goal, the long-term goal, is for us to create a tool, hopefully eventually an app, that people can have even on their phones that would allow them to take the form. Well, there is a form created by the courts, and it looks very simple. The problem is there's a lot of complicated stuff behind that form, and a lot of people are going to think, oh, this looks easy. I just check this, I check this, right. I check this. And it costs $250 to file. Now, if you're indigent by the standards of the court, someone who would get a public defender if you were charged with a crime, someone who usually is getting any kind of state or federal benefits, then you can have that fee waived. But if you fill out this form and send it in and you've made a mistake, if you paid the $250, you're going to lose it, and you have to wait another full year before you can file again. So there are some real disincentives to going forward with this without help. Now, if you have money, you're going to go online, you're going to find plenty of lawyers who try to explain parts of this statute, but in the course of that are constantly saying it's really difficult.
Right.
If you don't have money, you can't get a lawyer, okay? It's very hard. So what we're trying to do is develop a technology tool that's going to make it a whole lot easier, a guided interview that will then eventually create the form for you. Now, we're about a year away from that because of how long this takes. But in order to advance what we consider design thinking, getting end user input, as well as beginning to help people, we are going to have a series of expungement days or expungeathons, whatever we decide to call it, where we will make available the opportunity to have the forms filled out by the person who needs the form, but with the assistance of volunteer lawyers and law students, using some of the information that we have developed, which makes it easier. And then, and we're going to start that in April. And we hope to do that through the summer so that when the tool is developed, we will know exactly the kinds of questions that people have trouble with or need assistance on, and we can revise and revise and revise those questions, create pop-up boxes that explain the things that the lawyers are explaining, and then much of that will be self-contained. In Missouri, you don't need to have a lawyer to have this done. And the good news for people, especially people with very minor crimes, but convictions, but who are really hampered by those convictions, sometimes in the same way as people with felony convictions, and especially if you have a felony conviction that can be expunged, there's really going to be an opportunity to get this taken care of. And the expungement that you get, right, if you name in your form not only all the courts, okay, but the police agencies, the FBI listing, anybody that has a listing of this that is a government entity, the court can order that information can no longer be released. As we've talked about, we don't know about these private companies that put this information together and sell it. But what it does do, it allows you to say no. in answer to the question, do you have a conviction or an arrest for this particular offense? And it's not perjury or making a false statement. Mm-hmm. It is now a true statement. And if someone finds that, you can show them your court order. And that means that the court has found, okay, that your habits and conduct demonstrate that you're not a threat to public safety, and that in the expungement was consistent with the public welfare and the interests of justice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think employers and housing and so on are going to have to get used to this, but I think they're going to be pressured to have to consider this as the person not having a conviction.
Wow. And Bishop, I'm curious, what's your response to that? Is this what we're talking about when we try to we're talking about forgiveness, things like that, that maybe what Dean Suny's talking about is this is a way that people can then move on and say, all right, now I've been forgiven from the system to a certain extent and be able to move on as a full member of society.
Yeah. Also, just the ideal of, like you said, these private entities that will still buy this information and be out there with the law of the box being removed. I don't have to go and, you know, mark in if I was a felony, because that's no longer in existence. Now this employee goes to check my background and finds documentation that whatever crime and felony I did have has been expunged by the court, and that's a relief. Total relief, and that's just a new mindset now that a person feels total freedom to say, oh man, my life has just, you know, started over again. So that, just the thought, even when I've talked to individuals about this coming into this year for the state of Missouri, was, you know, I have numbers of several young men and women right now that I'm letting them know that we're going to, you know, I'm going to get you in front of the right individuals to help you have this expunge, and just the ideal of them lighting up. They just, you know, it just sparkles come to their eyes. Just the thought of, you know, these things mm-hmm. being able to be done. And certainly in the technology age that we're in now, for that to even be accessible, because a lot of people are very savvy, young people are, you know, quite mm-hmm. savvy in that, to be helped without an attorney, and knowing that burden, financial burden, I have to consistently pay something over because I've failed here and there, that, you know, that alleviates a lot. I'm just, you know, close to individuals that would say. Well,
and we've got 2 minutes left.
We hope to have, eventually, once we have this tool, a clinic where law students would get credit under my supervision for doing this. So that's longer term. I just don't want to create expectations, too many expectations. There are a lot of limitations in this statute.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's what we're going to help people initially, because we'll screen people. And if it's not expungible, we're going to keep a list of that because we can seek legislation to expand. But if a person's not within the waiting period, we'll tell them when they need to come and so on. Mm-hmm.
All right, and just a few seconds for Dion. Just briefly, this seems to dovetail, does it not? We've got, let's say, another 15 seconds for you, but it seems to dovetail, I believe, with your work as well, right? You're on the kind of the front end, and if it doesn't fit your criteria, we're going to get it on this back end.
Yes, that's right. And I think that, you know, everything we do, starting with the way we are attempting to now look at bonds because of the jail size we have, right up and through these diversion offers, are a representation of that. And frankly speaking, we want to stop the clock of the defense of saying, look, I'll take a misdemeanor on stealing, because that is going to impact you further down the road. And you might want to think about that diversion. If you're innocent, go to trial. If you want to take the help we're offering, take it, acknowledge it, apologize, and let's get you diverted.
My thanks to our wonderful guest today, Dean Suny, Bishop Morrison, and Dion Sankar. This is Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Now, the calendar for March 12th. Join the Midwest Innocence Project student organization of UMKC Law School for their second annual showing of Mind of the Innocent. The show will feature several poems and a full-length spoken word play, all of which have been created by and for wrongfully incarcerated individuals. This production will be held Tuesday, March 13th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Kick Comedy Theater behind the Westport Coffee House, 4010 Pennsylvania Avenue, KCMO. Doors open at 6 p.m. Show starts at 7 p.m. For more information and price, you can go to the Midwest Innocence Project Student Organization Facebook page or call 816-221-2166.
And now I want to talk with Charles Johnson from My Brother's Keeper about an incident that happened at 27th in Indiana, maybe about a month or so, Jeff. There was a homicide there at that gas station off of 27th in Indiana in Kansas City, Missouri. It's a Conoco gas station / donut thing, potato chips. There was a gentleman in the parking lot that was robbing, harassing the customers going in the store. Well, to make a long story short, he began to harass one of the customers in there, where he proceeds to attack from behind. And the gentleman turned around and stand the ground, legally able to carry a weapon, turned around and discharged, I believe it was 3 rounds, in this individual and left the premises. For the last 2 Saturdays, we have been at that location protesting. And our protest is the lack of security in that facility, because we honestly feel that there was security there that day, that would have been a form of deterrent of the violent acts that's going on. Within the last 15 months, this gas station's had 2 homicides and numerous 911 calls, meaning theft, robbery, et cetera, et cetera. But the gentleman that allegedly committed the last homicide there, Cameron Guy, was charged with second-degree murder on criminal action by Jackson County Prosecuting Office. So this coming Wednesday, the 14th, we'll be holding a rally at the Jackson County Courthouse. We just don't understand, why is a person that is defending themselves in a standing ground state being charged with second-degree murder and armed criminal action for defending themselves? The prosecutor attorney's office, we're feeling, is just abusing their discretion with these charges. Well, we feel or believe this is just another innocent man that's going to be locked up in the judicial system for a long period of time, come back 15, 20 years later, somebody will enter some new evidence and say, I'll be sorry, we'll let you out of prison. Well, we feel it can be stopped at this point. So we'll be gathering in front of the Jackson County Courthouse on 12th Street at 10 o'clock Wednesday, March the 14th. We already have signs made up for anyone that would like to participate. Thank you very much, sir.
My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News, and this is U.S. Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who's running for Ted Cruz's Senate seat. Recorded earlier this week out on the campaign trail, this is U.S. Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
So, we just read a note from a parent who went to a PTA meeting this week. And at the PTA meeting, of course, everyone was talking about the shooting that had just happened in Florida. And the parents at that PTA meeting were instructed on how to teach their children to respond to an active shooter who comes into their classroom with an AR-15. And this is what your child is supposed to do. They're supposed to act crazy. Now, this is the new guidance. Throw books, start screaming, run around that classroom. And the mom says, well, how is that going to save my kid's life that this person has an AR-15 and can very quickly kill every child in that classroom? And what they say is that it takes it from 10 seconds to kill every child in that classroom to 20 seconds when the kids are moving around. And in those extra 10 seconds, maybe some kids can get out the door. That is what we're talking about right now, is can we save some kids at the margin? So here's something I've done. And listen, this is as you know, politically charged as it comes in Texas. And this is how I hope you know that I have the courage of my convictions, because I'm willing to do this. I co-sponsored the assault weapons ban. And now I understand there are many Texans who own these AR-15s, and some of them are very good friends of mine that I've been out shooting with. And they said, Beto, why are you going to prevent me from buying a gun? I haven't hurt anybody. I haven't shot anybody. I keep this gun in a gun locker. I teach my kids gun safety. How could you do this? Because there's some crazy evil person in Florida or Sutherland Springs or Las Vegas, or pick the next city that's going to happen. And I say, you know what? You're right. We have the Second Amendment, and it's incredibly important. But the Second Amendment is not unlimited. You cannot carry a bazooka down the street. You cannot drive your tank down the street because we have the Second Amendment. There's going to have to be some rational limit to our ability that keeps more people in our communities safe and alive. And will I get the stuffing knocked out of me by the NRA for this? Just watch it come down on us in this campaign. But I've got to look myself in the mirror. And I'm not going to answer those moms who come to my town halls and say, what are you going to do? And I say, well, you know, we got to listen and understand, or we can't control this, or there's just evil in the world, or our thoughts and our prayers are with the parents. We got to do something. And if it means, you know, we're not as viable in the election, you know, so be it. What you want is my honest opinion on this stuff. You want to know that I have the courage and my convictions? I do, and I'm glad that you're with me on this one.
Beto O'Rourke is challenging Ted Cruz for his Texas Senate seat. The word thus far is that the turnout is up 102% for Democrats in Texas. Indications are that Congressman O'Rourke will be joining us here on the Cultural Baggage Show soon. This is Dean at DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.